Welcome back, everyone. I'm Cass Piancy, and as usual, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. Today, we are joined by a special guest, and I'm really happy to bring her on here. We have Frances Coppola, who is the author of The Case for People's Quantitative Easing and a finance and economics writer. She has a lot of perspectives on the cryptocurrency space, and I think a lot of people misinterpret her statements in general. So I'm looking forward to having this discussion, and I hope that a lot of people are interested in what she has to say. So I wanted to start this off briefly touching on inflation versus deflation and how both can be either good or bad. And I think there's a lot of confusion about that in the space in general. So maybe you can help everyone understand.
Okay, well, I think it would help if we first understood what inflation was. Inflation, as it's used in economics, is not simply expansion of the money supply. So if the Fed prints a whole lot of money, which it doesn't actually do, but we'll come on to that in a bit. But supposing it did, that is not inflation. Inflation is a general rise in the price level. In other words, the general price of goods and services in the economy rises. Now, a cause of that might be expansion in money supply, but there might be other causes as well. I mean, one of the causes at times in all economies has been rises in oil prices. Another cause has been what we call a wage price spiral, where prices start to rise. And so people demand more wages, wage rises to compensate for the losses they're taking because prices are rising. So employers give in, and then employers have to feed those price rises through to prices, and the whole thing escalates. And that's, generally speaking, the type of inflation that central banks try and prevent.
And that's hyperinflation, right? That's not normal inflation.
No, that's actually normal inflation.
Oh.
Hyperinflation is a slightly different phenomenon. I'm really just talking about normal inflation here, where prices rise, wages rise in response, prices rise because wages rise, and we end up with a wage price spiral. All that we have cost push inflation, where producer prices rise, say we've had oil price rises or world goods price rises or supply chain disruptions like we've got at the moment because of the COVID pandemic, and prices rise because of that. And again, we could get into a situation where people demand higher wages to compensate them for those kind of price rises. And that's the kind of thing that central banks control. Hyperinflation is always and everywhere associated, I think, with a collection of phenomena. The first is really a collapse of production or a very weak and damaged supply side. The second is political instability. And the third is external debt and often a fixed exchange rate. And then the fourth thing is money printing, but that's almost like the consequence of everything else. And then what the government has to do, what happens is the exchange rate collapses, and to hold the peg or to meet to pay its external debts, the government prints money because it can sell that money on the external markets, on foreign exchange markets, to service its external obligations. So obviously it has to print more and more and more of it as the exchange rate collapses. That's actually what happened in Weimar. The exchange rate of the mark fell. And as it did so, the government, the Reichsbank, had to print more and more and more money to enable the Weimar government to pay, to service its external debts and pay its reparations, because it had to pay them. It had foreign exchange debt. It had in dollars and pounds, francs, which it owed to the other powers in Europe. And it also had to pay reparations in gold. And that's how hyperinflation happens. So the external dimension of hyperinflation is hugely important. The other circumstance under which you can have hyperinflation, and again, it's still the same set of circumstances, a corrupt regime, political instability, a very weak supply side. Sometimes in the case of Zimbabwe, it was a government that actually set out to trash the productive side of its economy to pay off its cronies. And you can have a situation where the population rejects the currency, and that can also set off hyperinflation. But that's very different from the kind of ordinary inflation where, you know, prices rise, wages rise, and it's that type that central banks generally try to control.
I think we all have a basic understanding of why hyperinflation is bad. Like you mentioned, it tends to happen in places where everything is going wrong, so it is a signifier of problems. But Can we hear some positives about inflation and some maybe some positives about deflation too, if you know any?
Right. Now, the general kind of economic view of inflation is a little bit of inflation, and we are talking like, I don't know, 2-3% or more. It can actually be quite good for an economy because it can just stimulate it enough to get things going. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is what I would call money illusion. And that's the fact that most people think in nominal terms, they don't think in real terms. So if you've got a little bit of inflation, yes, okay, the value of your money is reducing slightly over time. But the nominal amount that people get, so the nominal amount that merchants get, the nominal amount that people get in wages rises, and people actually feel good when they see the nominal amount going up. It's just a fact of human psychology. And the second reason is actually to do with time preference, that although we need people to save in an economy, we do need people to prepare for their own futures, to make sure they have savings for their old age, and you know, to provide for themselves in the future if they're unable to work. But if everybody is saving at the same time and nobody is doing any spending other than basic subsistence, then you have a depressed economy. There's nothing moving. Everybody is sitting on things all the time and nothing's happening. There's no encouragement even to businesses to invest. And I think this is a fundamental problem that is often misunderstood in the crypto community. I'm often hearing people talking about time preference and saying that, of course, we need people to want to defer purchases, to save instead of spending, to build up capital for the future. Actually, in our world right now, we have more capital than we know what to do with, and that's why interest rates are on the floor and have been falling for 40 years. The problem is that we've been struggling to find productive uses for it, and there's lots of reasons for that. I think there are lots of things we could do with this capital, but for various reasons, we haven't wanted to, and that's a lot to do with risk aversion. And crypto, in a way, has relaxed that a bit, saying, well, actually, there are things we could spend our money on that we didn't think about before, and hey, we can play with this a bit. I would like that to spill over into other things. But if everybody is saving, and if the whole monetary paradigm encourages saving and not spending, then you have depression. And interestingly, there's another phenomenon that goes with that, which it could be neatly summed up as, if everybody is saving at the same time, nobody can save. It's actually known as the paradox of thrift. And it basically means that if your economy is so depressed because everybody's trying to save at the same time, then there isn't enough energy in the economy going forward to actually maintain the value of your savings over time.
On some level, that brings us to the main topic we're going to be discussing today. So cryptocurrencies and stablecoins. We're talking about inflation. We're talking about deflation. We're talking about uses for all of this extra capital. We're talking about low interest rates. And we're talking about how this entire ecosystem has kind of flourished under cheap capital and lack of regulation. We're right now in the midst of, I can only assume, is intense regulatory action on stablecoins. What do you think stablecoins are? Why do you think regulators are going after them right now? And do you think there's a place for them?
I'm notoriously down on stablecoins, aren't I? I guess they serve a need in the crypto ecosystem because of the relationship with fiat currency, whether we like it or not. The way in which you get things to work in the cryptocurrency ecosystem right now is actually by using fiat. And actually, the crypto ecosystem has a real shortage of fiat. It's actually really difficult to get fiat in and out of the system. And so stablecoins emerged, and they go back quite a while. I mean, I think Tether has been around since 2014, really as a way of easing that liquidity problem, making it possible for people to trade cryptocurrencies without having to go in and out of fiat all the time. And that's actually kind of a reasonable thing to have, is that kind of token that is like a safe asset, performs the same function in the cryptocurrency ecosystem as US treasuries do in the fiat ecosystem. I mean, they are safe assets. They are what everybody flies into. And there are some others as well, like the Japanese yen and the euro and the Swiss franc. And stablecoins serve that function, and they also serve the function, because they're interoperable between exchanges, of enable people to move fiat from one exchange to the other to resolve liquidity problems. So from that point of view, they're actually useful things. And I don't want to be that down on stablecoins, because you know, they clearly do serve a useful function. You need some kind of safe asset like that in a functioning monetary system that is cut off from central banks and doesn't want to have central banks. And the main problem you have is that your stable coins increasingly start acting like central banks, which is a little bit of what's going on right now. There's also the collateral argument as well. I mean, the stable coins are used as collateral in crypto lending markets and derivatives and what have you. And you know, financial markets need safe assets as collateral. We, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, we actually saw what happened when financial markets became very short of collateral, was that all sorts of things seized up and didn't work properly, and central banks had to do things to try and ease collateral shortages.
This bridges into the other part of the question, though, because what you just said is the financial system relies on safe assets. Are stablecoins safe assets?
Well, this is the question. They should be. That's the nature of a stablecoin. It should be a safe asset. It should be something that people can rely on. And they are marketed that way as things that people can rely on as being always equivalent to dollars. So safe assets in that respect. If your dollar is safe, then so is your stablecoin. We can argue about whether dollars are safe. That's a separate discussion. But if we are assuming that in a way, for the crypto ecosystem, the dollar is the ultimate safe asset in much the same way as gold was the ultimate safe asset in the past, then the stable coins are creating that link between a highly volatile financial market infrastructure and a stable asset, which isn't terribly liquid in that environment, which is the dollar. It's difficult to get in and out. Then you create something that's equivalent to it. It's not, in that respect, it's a little bit like the Eurodollar before the financial crisis, which were these like dollar proxies that operated offshore. Are stable coins actually safe? And this is the question. This is what all the fuss has been about recently, is are they really safe? Now, I want to separate them out into different groups, because we have reserved stable coins like USDC, Gemini Coin, Pax, and I include Tether in that, actually. I know that people have been saying maybe it's a bit different, and I don't think it is. They are reserved stable coins. They originally claimed, all of them, including Tether, to be fully backed 100% by actual US dollars. And we now know that for two of them, that's not the case. One is Tether and the other is USDC, which has now released the composition of its reserves. And funnily enough, it's got corporate bonds in there and commercial paper and all sorts, same sorts of stuff as Tether, which means that it's got credit risk. And it's got liquidity risk. And what that means is that instead of having actual US dollars backing the tokens that you use on the exchanges, it's got some US dollars. In the case of USDC at the moment, we don't know how many. With Tether, we do. But the rest of it is in things that may or may not be easily saleable in the event of people wanting their tokens to be redeemed, and may or may not be easily saleable at the price that is needed to redeem all the tokens. They might have to be redeemed at quite a hefty discount. Now, when that happens, then those who come for redemption first get the returns, and those who come late to the party get nothing. And so you can't say that your stablecoin is fully backed. Really, these stablecoins should be trading at a discount to the dollar now. They are actually, because they don't have 100% dollar backing.
There's implied risk.
So there's credit risk, there's liquidity risk, there's market risk. And that risk should be priced in, and that should feed through into a discount. The problem with this for a stablecoin is, if you think about stablecoin, the whole point of a stablecoin is that it holds its par value to the dollar. If it doesn't hold its par value to the dollar, what on earth is the point? And in this respect, I think comparing this to money market funds is actually wrong. And I know that in 2008 and again in 2020, money market funds did break the buck. They weren't able to deliver par value. But in actual fact, since 2008, money market funds have had to say that the value is not guaranteed, that they're offering a net asset value of endeavouring to reach $1 per share, but it might not. And arguably, they should never have given the implied guarantee in the first place. But at least with a money market fund, you're putting your money into a fund, and the fund is going to invest it in cash-like instruments in order to deliver some kind of return. Now, it's possible, as with all fund investments, that you can lose some money. And that is all a money market fund is a fund in which you put some money in the expectation that it's going to be invested for a return. And it's just possible that it might all go pear-shaped and you won't get all your money back. Now, but with a stablecoin, you're not putting money into a fund. You're buying you're buying tokens in the expectation you'll then be able to trade those tokens, right?
And one of the interesting things I want to touch on here, just because I think some people might not pick up on this, I think what you're talking about is that when I put my money, my US dollars, into a money market fund, let's say on Fidelity, I'm going for that not only because, oh, it's liquid and I can, you know, trade with it or whatever, but also because I'm getting a higher yield than if it was just sitting there. You get no yield with a stablecoin. There is no yield. You're not getting any extra interest on that stablecoin unless you're giving it to a lending platform.
Exactly. So you actually buying stablecoin, whereas with a money market fund, if you put your money into that fund, you are, in a way, giving it to the fund for it to invest on your behalf. With stablecoin, you're not doing that. You're just buying some tokens. You're not going to get any yield on those tokens unless you then invest the tokens. You stake them somewhere for an APY of something incredible or whatever. So the onus is all on you. If all you do is you buy your stablecoin and you hold it, you don't get anything, because the whole point is the stablecoin is worth exactly the same like 2 months from now as it was when you bought it. And that's kind of not the point. They don't bear interest. So it's not like a money market fund. And I think comparing it to a money market fund is wrong. I also think for the same reason that comparing it to banks is wrong. Because, yes, okay, banks aren't giving anything in the way of interest on demand deposits at the moment. They're giving a little bit of interest on notice deposits. But you're still placing your money with the bank in the expectations it'll do something productive with it to earn a yield. That's not what you're doing when you buy a token. And there's another way in which reserved stablecoins, we're not talking about algorithmic ones yet, I'll come onto those in a minute, in which reserved stablecoins are different from both banks and money market funds. And that is that when you buy tokens, when you buy USDT or USDC, you're not buying it directly from the issuer. You're buying it from an exchange. Right, the money you pay goes to the exchange. Right, now the exchange gets its tokens from the issuer, and we assume it pays the issuer for them, but we don't know how it pays the issuer. It might be issuing commercial paper for all we know. We have no idea what the relationship is between the exchange and the stablecoin issuer, and therefore we don't actually know what relationship there is between the stablecoin issuer and the customer. In some cases, we have a user agreement, and you people really need to look at the user agreement, because that governs how much right, for example, you have to redemption. If you look at Tether's user agreement, you would discover that actually, if you are an ordinary punter holding USDT, you have no guaranteed right of redemption in dollars. And that might surprise a lot of people. Of course I can redeem. Well, no, if your exchange suspends trading in USDT and you go to Tether saying, give me my dollars, Tether can turn around and say no. Now, banks don't actually have that right. And neither do money market funds. Money market funds have the right not to give you your money back. And banks, well, if you have your money in an insured bank account, you're entitled to your money back.
So I think related to this, if you don't see stablecoins as analogous to banks or analogous to money market funds, what do you see them as similar to? And how does that affect their place in the regulatory financial landscape?
Right now, and you know, this is going to sound very pejorative, and I don't mean it that way, but I think we have to look at what these things are. Right now, stablecoins are like casino chips. What you're doing is you are buying the means by which you can play on the crypto casinos. Now, the thing about casino chips is that you buy your chips from the casino, and when you've had your game and you've maybe won some money, if you're lucky, when you leave, you cash them out, don't you? And you expect that your house will give you your money, because your casino chips are still worth what you bought them for. You might have earned some more, or you might have lost some. But the actual value of one chip is exactly what it was when you bought it. Now, that's the promise that stablecoin issuers make, that the value of one token will be exactly what it was when you bought it. You may win some, you may lose some while you play on the crypto casinos, but the actual value of the stablecoin will be the same. And because we now know that the two major ones are not hanging on to the dollars they need to enable you to cash out, and furthermore, in at least one case, are putting in restrictions to make it very difficult for you to get your dollars back, they're not actually even acting quite as well as casinos do, which is a bit worrying. I would expect them at least to act to that standard. I mean, you know, with casinos, we know the house never loses, so the chances are you probably lose some money. But, you know, you do expect them to actually have enough money to be able to allow you to cash out.
I think this is perfect segue to, is this why regulators are finally making some moves now?
Yes, I think it is. What's happening is that people are putting real money into this. So they're putting money, they're buying tokens, they're buying stable coins. And the stable coins are not demonstrating that they have the funds available to be able to allow people to cash out. And that's worrying. So regulators are beginning to say, actually, if you buy these things, you may never get your money back. And furthermore, also, I think regulators are getting concerned about the fact that the only use of these things is to play on casinos, on unregulated casinos, where you literally can lose your shirt. I found it quite telling looking at the proposed framework for regulation of stablecoins from the Bank of International Settlements recently, that they created a set of stablecoins, if you like, that as far as I can see doesn't actually exist right now, which is fully reserved stablecoins with strict disclosure standards and capital and liquidity requirements like banks. And they said, well, if these meet the requirements, then, you know, we'll allow them to operate, we'll allow them to be used for payments. But everything else, which means just about every existing stablecoin, as far as I can tell, is incredibly risky and, among other things, is not suitable to be used as collateral. The headline reports on this wax lyrical about the 1,250% risk weighting on cryptocurrencies and stablecoins, which translated into you need 100% for banks, you need 100% capital to hold these things. But what got lost in that was the BIS's recommendation that no existing cryptocurrencies or stablecoins were suitable for use as collateral and recommended 100% haircut on all of them. When we talk about stablecoins in the cryptocurrency world, when we're using cryptocurrencies as collateral, I mean, you'll hear people talking about over-collateralization, saying, oh, everything's safe because it's very over-collateralized, much more over-collateralized than it is in the real financial markets. And I kind of go, yeah, have you not never heard of a haircut? In crypto, they talk about over-collateralization. In traditional markets, we talk about haircuts. If you have 100% haircut, then your collateralization requirement is infinite. And that's way, way more collateral than is ever required in decentralized finance.
Can you kind of expand on that just a little bit more? Some assets in traditional finance essentially require infinite collateral, or could technically, and a 100% haircut, right? Meaning that. Dumb it down for someone like me a little bit more, if you can.
Actually, as far as I can tell, absolutely no assets in traditional finance require infinite capacity, infinite collateral, except stablecoins and cryptocurrencies. even junk bonds don't carry haircuts like that. The BIS are basically saying these things are more risky than anything in traditional finance. And it's actually quite interesting looking at the kind of over-collateralization that's required in finance. And I'd recommend everybody to go and look at eligible collateral for, say, the Federal Reserve. Central banks produce lists of eligible collateral, and it shows you the haircuts. And what you need to do is convert the haircut, which is the amount by which you reduce the value of your collateral. Okay, so if you have if you're placing collateral of 100,000, you're borrowing 100,000, you're placing collateral, then if you've got a 70% haircut on the assets you're pledging, then you're going to have to over collateralize by a lot. And if you actually do the maths, that is a very, very considerable over-collateralization. A 50% haircut is 200% over-collateralization. And obviously, the bigger the haircut, the bigger the percentage. And it's exponential until by the time your haircut approaches 100%, your collateralization multiple is potentially infinite. And that was where the BIS was going, basically saying these things are not suitable to be used as collateral at all. And therefore, the haircut is 100%. So you need infinite over collateralization. You just can't use them. And the same assets are being used in decentralized finance with collateralizations of, I don't know, 150%, 200%, maybe 300, 400%. And that's tiny compared to what the BIS is talking about. So, you know, we have a difference of opinion about how risky these things are. Let's put it that way, depending on who you talk to. In the cryptocurrency world, they're regarded as, most stable coins are regarded as fairly safe. Tether in decentralized finance, it requires more over collateralization, I think, than USDC does. And, you know, there is a bit of a hierarchy there, but none of them attract the kind of over collateralization that is recommended for them in the traditional finance world.
That's going to do it for part one with Francis Coppola, everyone. Part two is going to be coming out in roughly 2 or 3 days. Give me a little time to work on it. Sorry this is taking so long. I've been busy. I have no good excuse other than that. Anyway, thank you for listening, and we will have more for you shortly.